Please be seated. I want to thank you for accommodating the memorial for Judge Fairchild, which got scheduled for today at the convenience of a whole number of people who participated, so appreciate that. I'll now call our third case, 2005 AP 1492 CR, State of Wisconsin versus Marcus Johnson. Arguing on behalf of Marcus Johnson is Brian C. Finley, Deputy First Assistant State Public Defender, Madison. Counsel? Okay. We'll mark that down on this sheet. Is that less or more pay?
Less.
I'm sorry.
Mark that down.
Right. I nearly gave you a pay raise, unauthorized. Counsel, you may proceed.
Good afternoon. In State versus Thompson, the Court of Appeals held that continuing custody in a juvenile correctional facility was not a sentence and therefore did not sever any right to credit against pending criminal charges. I'm asking you to affirm that case, apply it to Mr. Johnson, and grant him 617 days in credit.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Just so I understand, where was he held? Where was your client held?
He was arrested on June 3rd, 2002.
Yes.
And he was held at the Mendota Juvenile Treatment Center until, I believe, June 13th, when he was sent back to Ethan Allen School.
So he was always in the juvenile facility?
He was transported to the Dane County Jail, and as I added up, I see that he was held 32 days in the Dane County Jail.
Except for the 32 days, was he held in a juvenile facility?
That's correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Was bail set from the June 3rd arrest until his initial appearance?
No, Your Honor. It was set at on July 16, 2002, his initial appearance. So I don't. There was no bail set that I'm aware of.
There was no bail. He was not being held in custody as with respect to a bail order.
There was no signature bond or anything like that. That's correct.
Mr. Finley, when he was held in the Dane County Jail, was it in a juvenile detention section of the jail?
I don't believe that there is such a thing. I'm not sure that the record has it, but I believe that he was held in segregation.
Okay. Is there not a secure juvenile detention facility
There is a secure juvenile detention center, and there is an affidavit attached from Janice Balastrari, his attorney, saying that the normal procedure would be to hold him in secure detention, but that that did not occur in this case, that he was actually held in the regular jail.
In the adult section of the jail, but in a segregated cell.
That's correct.
Thank you.
I'll get to the bail bond later, but I'd like to address the rule in Thompson first. And I think there's three main reasons why you should apply that rule to Mr. Johnson. First, the statute says that you're entitled to credit whenever you're held in connection with a pending charge. And in this case, the judge made a clear ruling that there is, quote, no question that he was held in connection with his criminal charges. The second reason is that the legislature intended to apply credit broadly. And the state has asked you to adopt a different test, a but-for test. And I don't see any basis for that in the statute itself. Furthermore, I don't see any basis for it in the legislative history. There's never been a claim, as far as I can tell, that that's what the legislature intended. And finally, and this might be the most important reason, is that the state's but-for test is completely unworkable. What it asks courts to do is say to the Department of Corrections, okay, we know you considered the fact that he was charged with these adult charges, but pretending that didn't happen, would you have held him in custody anyway or not? It's asking for rank speculation. It's putting a burden on the courts, on attorneys, and ultimately on defendants, and it's a bad rule. So I'd ask you not to apply that rule.
Mr. Finley, going to the arguments, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Johnson was in custody with respect to a different offense before this battery was committed. He was in the juvenile detention treatment facility, correct?
He was serving multiple juvenile dispositions.
And as I understand it, Judge Nix extended his confinement under that commitment until May of 2003, and that extension was prior to the battery that was committed on June 2nd.
That's correct. He was extended on May 20th, 2002.
Well, how, I guess I'm trying to follow the argument, how he would be entitled to credit, particularly if he's not sitting on bail, for the time period for which he has already been extended for behavior that occurred prior to the battery in question.
It's true that he was extended, but it's also true that he could have been released at any time. That's the juvenile system is completely different than the adult system. It's not a determinate sentence. And the courts, the department can, if they think a new medicine or a new treatment or whatever has changed their analysis, they can release the juvenile or they can ask for a revision of the order at any time. The fact that there was an extension meant that he could serve up to May 20th, 2003, but it certainly did not mean that he would serve up to May 20th, 2003. And I think there's a big difference. We're dealing with a indeterminate system, and that's what the court said in State versus Thompson. They said, you know, the whole concept of credit is meaningless where you're dealing with a system where sentence or dispositions are so fluid as they are in juvenile cases. So the fact that he was extended, I've had many clients who are extended and then let go very soon after, but they were waiting for them to complete a treatment or a program or, you know, all kinds of things can factor into it. And one of the things we saw in this case is that at one point he responded well to a medicine. These kinds of things happen, and the department can, and often does, release juveniles well before their orders have expired.
But here,
I ask the question is because you've made the argument that the state's test is unworkable. Mm-hmm. But as I hear your argument, wouldn't we be engaging in the same type of speculation? Could have, he's extended until a certain date, but he could be released. And so wouldn't we be asking the trial courts to go back and make those same types of determinations that you say we shouldn't be making with respect to the state's argument?
Well, I'm sorry, I don't quite understand your question.
Well, as I understand your argument that there's a custody aspect here.
Right.
We're not dealing with the bail question yet.
Right.
But your argument regarding a custody issue with respect to at least the 340 days is that he may have been extended by Judge Nix, but he could have been released.
That's correct.
And so somebody's got to make a determination as to whether he would have been released in order to determine whether or not he's entitled to custody. I think that goes to the state's argument, well, you've got a factual vacuum here in their argument as to why we should perhaps remand this back. But that's part of the dilemma that I see with respect to your argument that are we speculating? Do we have to have findings? Do we need a hearing? Do we have a sufficient record?
I don't think remand is appropriate. The question that the Court of Appeals certified said, quote, unless there is a meaningful distinction for purposes of sentence credit between juvenile confinement and adult incarceration that we have not uncovered, it seems that either Beetz or Thompson was wrongly decided. I don't think you can remand until you answer that question. Now, I happen to think the Court of Appeals got the answer to the first part of the Court of Appeals question is, yes, they're different. And that's why we treat them differently. But I don't think remand is appropriate. You're saying, well, aren't we speculating? That's the problem with their test. You will always be speculating because there is no definite day at which the juvenile will be out. They can be extended. They can be released. So you're all, excuse me, once again, I violated the cardinal rule that you should never say always. But they do consider these things. It is a very fluid situation. And the fact that he was extended does not mean that he would have spent all of that time in custody.
Counselor, but can't you say the same thing of an adult who's sentenced under indeterminate sentencing, that the parole board could always review him and let him out? I mean, you'd have to have a motion in juvenile court to review him and terminate his secure custody. So, I mean, I don't see how it's all that different from an adult on indeterminate sentencing.
Well, there are multiple reasons why I think it's different than an adult case. First of all, this court has said that the Juvenile Justice Code is not a criminal code. That's what you said in Hezier. You said there are reasons to distinguish between the two, and I think you should stick with that. But more than that, the statute creates a distinction. 938-35 says that a judgment under Chapter 938 is not a conviction of a crime. And we know from 973-155 that a sentence is only imposed for a conviction. So in State versus Woods, the Court of Appeals concluded that the term conviction does not include an adjudication. So there's a statutory reason to distinguish. At the time that Dietz was decided, it was an indeterminate sentence, which is, I think, where you're going with your question. I don't think you have to adhere to it. I think certainly within the context of juvenile cases, the argument is stronger that it's a much more fluid situation. And there are these statutory differences. So that's why I would distinguish it.
Counsel, you asked questions about the extension previously by Justice Butler, and there were a couple of extensions here.
That's correct.
The first extension, as I recall, maybe around May of 2002, I may be wrong, but that was before the battery was committed, or at least that extension was before. Then he came up for an extension again, and at that time, in that court report, petitioning for an extension of time, the criminal charge was referenced.
That's correct. He was extended again on May 6, 2003. And at that point, the fact that he had pending criminal charges was factored into the decision to extend him again. So that just demonstrates, I think, why there is a connection between pending criminal charges and custody and juvenile corrections. The reality is that they can do these reviews at any time. I don't know OJOR's rules, Office of Juvenile Offender Review, but that they do them periodically, and that when they do review the case, they look at all of the behavior since the last review. And so they are constantly looking at the fact that there are adult criminal charges, and we see that explicitly in this case. The second, yes.
Would you like to tell me just how you're interpreting 973.155?
Okay.
Isn't that the issue in the case?
Well, sure. The statute says
your client is a convicted offender, right?
Well, he is at this point, yes. Okay. But at the time, he was adjudicated delinquent.
Okay.
And the statute says that a convicted offender shall be given credit toward the service of his or her sentence.
We're talking now about the crime. for which
That's
he was
correct.
Convicted. Okay.
For all days spent in custody in connection with the course of conduct for which sentence was imposed.
And so you're saying custody includes juvenile detention.
That's right, because the fact, the mere fact that he's picked up these criminal charges is connected to the amount of time he is doing on the criminal charges. The juvenile charges. The juvenile adjudication.
And the statute uses the word custody, and it uses the word confinement.
That's correct.
Related to offense, and you're saying he was in custody and he was confined for all the time that he was in juvenile facilities after the he was charged with the battery. Is that your position?
That's correct. And I think the state has conceded consistently the fact that he was in custody. I don't see that as being particularly the issue in this case, that they've questioned whether he was held in connection with.
Is all this time that you want either while he was awaiting trial for the crime?
Yes.
While he was being tried for the crime?
That's correct.
And while he was awaiting imposition of sentence after crime?
That's correct. So by the clear terms of the statute, which creates, asks you to look, is there a connection, he's entitled to credit. And he's entitled to credit because in this case the judge said there is no question, the trial court judge, that the June 3, 2002 battery was one of a number of factors the department considered in maintaining custody. So there was, by the court's finding, a connection between the juvenile dispositional time and his pending criminal charges.
In other words, the state's argument that there were other infractions, other incidents, which in the red brief was brought to our attention, what do you do with those? They just don't count?
Well, they do count, but the statute was intended to grant credit broadly, and as long as there is a connection, which there is in this case, he's entitled to credit. Now,
So the idea is that after you're convicted and you're held, then it doesn't make any difference what your conduct is, because then you can do anything you want. Is that the?
No, that's not the case. I mean,
why isn't it the case?
Well, for one thing, you can be charged with new crimes, and all of that conduct is relevant at sentencing in this case. I mean, he's still awaiting sentencing in this case, and you can be plenty sure that the DA is going to say, Your Honor, as they did in this case, this guy's not done very well, and that you should sentence him accordingly. As I hear your question, it's
kind of... My question is that the state is saying, well, there were numerous other infractions that occurred before and particularly after this incident, and that's why he would have been continued in custody.
You cannot say that with certainty. And that's the problem with the state's position, is that if you say that, you're discounting altogether the fact that he's got pending adult charges. And that is something that they consider when they're deciding whether to maintain his custody in juvenile correction. So, I mean, you can't discount the fact that they do consider it as well. And you know, as I hear your question, it sounds a little bit like, aren't you trying to get away with something? I mean, you know, okay, because the state had control of this. They had control of when this guy, where he was incarcerated. They had control over when they could have asked for the trial. I mean, he's not getting away with something. And furthermore, the possible sentence in this case was 12 and a half years. He could have gotten a lot more time. And all of those minor offenses that you're talking about were considered by the court at sentencing. I think they're relevant there, and I think that's the time that you incorporate them into the sentencing.
Mr. Finley, if I could.
Yes.
In fact, question in the record may not reflect this, and if it doesn't, so be it. But I recall many instances when I was on the circuit court bench that judges would often issue a signature bond to revert to cash in order to allow an individual to go into a treatment program, to go in another type of program. The idea being that, okay, we'll allow you to develop whatever you need to develop for purposes of sentencing on this case, to go into this program, might be as a condition of bond or whatever. But as soon as that program is over, I want you back in custody, so it will revert to cash bond. As I understand it in this case, since we just had the straight signature bond, if there had been cash bail set in this case, would Mr. Johnson have sat in the Dane County Jail awaiting trial, or would he have gone back to the juvenile facility?
I don't know the answer to that. And because I don't think there is a definite answer. And I know that when the legislature drafted the Juvenile Justice Code, the expectation was that when these juveniles turn a certain age, they go to the prison, certainly if they're convicted of one of the more serious offenses. But to be honest, that's not what's happening. And there's a reason for that, and that's because these kids are kids. And the department, in its discretion, often decides, well, we'd rather have them in Ethan Allen, Lincoln Hills, or Southern Oaks. Now, that's not the way the legislature drafted it, but that's what's happening. And so I don't know where he would have been. It doesn't make a difference for my analysis, I guess, except...
Well, there is the second issue about whether or not he's in custody in the absence of cash bail. Now, I understand your argument is that there's multiple ways of looking at custody here, and we're hooking this into the fact that his juvenile detention was extended beyond. But you still have that issue of the absence of cash bail in this case, do you not?
Right. But I guess what I'm asking is that in this case, for equitable reasons, I would ask that you grant Mr. Johnson credit despite the fact that he was issued a signature bond rather than cash bail. And there's a bunch of reasons for that. The first one is that, as we've just discussed, the fact that he has pending charges affects his amount of, potentially affects his amount of time he serves on his disposition, despite the fact that there's a signature bond. It's also unfair, I think, to apply the rule that the signature bond severs the right to credit to juveniles, particularly one such as him. He turned 15, and 3 days later he signed a signature bond, and all that was explained to him was, if you sign it, you go back to Ethan Allen. That's all that was explained to him. I don't think that's fair. And furthermore, it's not fair to...
But that may be pertinent. You said that he was told that if he signed the signature bond, he would go back to Ethan Allen.
That's what the judge told him at that point.
And was the converse also indicate that if he did not sign it, he would stay at the Dane County Jail?
It wasn't worded that way. It was just said, and I'm paraphrasing from memory, is that, you know, if you sign this, the only thing that will happen is you'll go back to Ethan Allen.
Do you understand the import of my question? Because if the judge is making a ruling, a bail ruling, to benefit the defendant, it might make our decision a little bit different than if he's doing it for some other purpose. And if the purpose is to get him into a facility, so we're going to send him back to a juvenile facility, we'll send him to a treatment facility, we're going to let him go through it and embark on a certain program. And I know you can't do that if you have cash bond. They're going to hold you at the jail. So I'm going to allow you to go. And I know we do that in circuit court. I know that was done many times in both the adult and juvenile setting. So if that's what's being done here, it seems a little bit harder to argue that you're therefore entitled to credit for getting the benefit of being able to go back to a juvenile facility.
We don't know that was being done here. And in fact, there are juveniles convicted of murders and so on who have remained in the juvenile system past the age of 15. And so It's not clear to me at all what would have happened had he not signed the signature bond. What happened was, I think it was just pretty much pro forma sign the signature bond. That's what happened. I don't think there was any real consideration of, we're trying to get you to Ethan Allen or something like that. And so I don't see that as being what was occurring here. I'll have to go back and reread the transcript, but that's not how I read it. It was pretty short. And the only thing that was said to him was that, you know, if you sign the signature bond, the only consequence will be you go back to Ethan Allen.
Counsel, the Court of Appeals seemed to think in its certification that there was potentially a conflict between Thompson and Beetz. You think there is?
I don't believe that there is a conflict between the two, because Beetz, by its own terms, applies to the criminal law. And Thompson applies to the juvenile law. And I think there's a distinction, as I just addressed earlier, that the juvenile and the criminal are two different spheres. They should be treated differently. And that you can say, yeah, a sentence severs a connection between the two, but a disposition is not a sentence.
Thank you, Mr. Finley. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Christopher Wren, Assistant Attorney General, Madison, Wisconsin.
Thank you, Your Honor. On behalf of the state, I'm asking the court to do several things in this case. One is to affirm the decision of the circuit court that denied sentence credit to Mr. Johnson. Second, to reaffirm this court's decision in Beetz as the touchstone for the test of whether confinement occurs in connection with the course of conduct for which a sentence was imposed. Third is to reject Mr. Johnson's proposed rule that a juvenile held in juvenile corrections pending criminal sentencing is always held in custody in connection with the criminal charges. And finally, if necessary, to your decision to overrule Thompson. I want to make a couple of points about the issue of the statute. There's been a lot of talk about speculation here and so on. I think the problem with the speculation issue, it's been presumed that the speculation has to be resolved by the state. That's not correct. The determination of whether sentence credit is due is a burden of the defendant to make that showing, and it has to be a factual showing. So to the extent that there is any kind of speculation going on, it's Mr. Johnson's responsibility to resolve that in his favor. It's not our obligation as the state to show that he is not entitled to it. That's the presumption that attends to 973.155. The issue in this case is custody, and it's not a question of whether custody occurs in connection with another sentence for a crime, as in Beetz, or a juvenile disposition, as in Thompson. The statute, the 973.155, does not distinguish the basis for the custody that might otherwise exist. That's why we've argued that the custody in this case all occurred in connection with the juvenile dispositions and was not in connection with the criminal charges that were filed against Mr. Johnson. The question about speculation here has to do with the discretion that the Department of Corrections has to release somebody. Again, I come back to the point that it's Mr. Johnson's responsibility to show that he would have been released, not the state's responsibility to somehow demonstrate that he wouldn't have been released. I think if you look at the record that was supplemented for this court, one of the things you can see in there is a record that would have kept Mr. Johnson in the juvenile facility throughout this entire period, even if these charges hadn't been brought. I outlined those in my chronology in the brief, and you have these multiple offenses that by themselves were going to keep him there. Now, the judge in the circuit court said, used the term extremely high probability, and there's been discussion about probability not being enough. What the judge didn't have were those records that are now in front of this court. That's one of the reasons that when the Court of Appeals talked about there being no support in the record for my assertion that he would have been kept there, that's why the Court of Appeals found a factual gap in this record. And that's why, in part, to the extent that you believe that there's still a factual gap, this case should be remanded back to the circuit court for that finding. Now, the claim that the but-for test is unworkable, I think, is incorrect. I think, as Justice Butler was pointing out, you get to the same problem with the speculation about whether he would have been released or whether he wouldn't have been released from the juvenile facility. But the but-for test is tied into the question of in connection with. In connection with inevitably raises a factual question that has to be resolved at some point. The reason I think that we don't see many cases dealing with whether custody, a joint kind of custody, was in connection with or not, is because a lot of this gets resolved either through stipulation or through an accurate calculation at the circuit court level. The disputes don't often arise. But when they do arise, when there is not a clear delineation, as with a sentence severing the connection, as in Beats, then you are into the question of how to resolve a fact. And that's a fact, and the fact that we haven't had so many factual inquiries by the courts, I think, is simply a function of the reality that these sentence credit questions get resolved usually pretty amicably.
Mr. Wren, if I could, you've mentioned now the but-for test. I'm looking at 973.155. The statute uses the language in custody in connection with the course of conduct for which sentence was imposed. I don't see anything in the statute that says but for.
And I'm not claiming that the statute says that. I'm claiming that derives from Beats and the way the court decided Beats. Because I think the argument can be made, and the point was made earlier here, that how do you distinguish this discretionary release available under the juvenile code with discretionary release that's available for an indeterminate sentence? Both of them involve some kind of speculation. Yet in the adult situation, we say we aren't going to engage in that speculation. We are going to assume that the disposition, that sentence, that the custody is in relation to that and in connection with that, and any other custody, even if you've got other charges pending.
But as I understood Beats, the rationale for that, and I haven't looked at Beats since we began the preparation on this case a couple months ago, but as I understood the rationale of Beats, it's because when a person is sentenced on another case, they're no longer in custody in connection with the offense. I don't understand the need to go in the direction of a new test or new language. It's simply because when you were sentenced on another violation, you're in custody for that other violation. So any continued custody is no longer in connection with that offense. Am I misreading Beats?
Well, as I understand Beats, the rationale was that the sentence made it clear that you were in jail, you were confined for that on that charge, and that even if you have other charges pending, if you remove those charges, you would still not be free. And I see that as kind of a but-for test. If you are in there in connection with that offense, and that offense is dropped, you're going to get out. If you aren't, then you're in there for some other reason, and your confinement, your custody, is not in connection with that charge that was dropped. My point here is that Mr. Johnson was in the juvenile facility based on a prior disposition that was then extended. There's nothing in the record to show that he would have been or even had a likelihood of being released after these charges were brought, and that had these charges not been the subject of criminal this conduct not been the subject of a criminal charge, he still would have been there.
Would the state be making the same argument if cash bail had been set as opposed to a signature bond in this case?
Yes, we would. And our position is that the difference, that there's an asymmetric relationship here between signature bond and cash bond. Suppose you had two charges, a misdemeanor charge and a felony charge, that were brought at the same time. The judge, for whatever reason, says, I'm going to put you on cash bond of $100 on the misdemeanor. I'm not going to release you at all on the felony charge. If the defendant, for some reason, came up with $100, he's still not going to leave. The cash bond is may create a presumption that he's in there because of that cash bond. But I think that again creates a factual question. We generally don't litigate whether a cash bond results in the person being in there.
I guess the reason I asked the question of whether your argument would be different is I could foresee many difficulties down the road for the state if we were to read your argument as you're making it here today, if we were to adopt that argument, because oftentimes, at least at the trial court level, that's exactly what the trial court judge is looking at, is there cash bond on this case. And if there's cash bond, notwithstanding the fact that you may have some of it, the trial court is generally going to give credit, as I recall. And so if we're going to treat the cash bond and signature bond the same, I'm concerned about how that's going to impact future arguments that the state is going to make when we get to those sentence credit issues.
I'm not saying that they're treated the same. I'm saying that one does sever. I mean, if you've got a signature bond, you're free to walk. And if you aren't walking, it must mean that confinement is in connection with something else that's going on, not the case or not the charges on which the signature bond has been created. What I'm saying is the cash bond creates a presumption that the confinement is in connection with the offense for which the cash bond has been imposed. But I don't think it should be read as an automatic award of sentence credit. Now, I think this gets back to my earlier point that a lot of these cases get resolved without much dispute because the prosecutor doesn't necessarily have an interest in fighting it. There are lots of practical reasons why these don't occur. I don't foresee that we're going to have a lot of disputes, if any, by treating cash bond as a presumption as opposed to a mandate on this.
I ask you a question about the Thompson case?
Yes, sir.
This was decided in 1999. The state, I believe, asked for a petition, filed a petition for review.
I don't recall whether the state filed a petition for review on that.
Well, it's been around. I think a petition for review was filed.
Okay.
I'm just looking at the report here. Let me put it this way. Has this decision in Thompson created any problems? I mean, I would think this is a fairly common situation.
Well, my recollection is that the Thompson has been cited only once in a published opinion, and that was this one, or in the certification. It's hardly been used at all, which is what makes this kind of odd in the sense. In fact, the Court of Appeals itself in the Thompson decision characterized it as an unusual set of facts. And I think that's an accurate characterization. We haven't seen it cited, and that could be for a couple of reasons. One is the trial courts aren't dealing with it the same way that they did with Thompson, or that the issues have been resolved again between defense counsel and prosecutor on how to award sentence credit in those situations. But I don't think Thompson has created a huge problem. It's created a problem here based on what the District 4 regarded as a conflict between Beetz and Thompson. But elsewhere, I don't think it has.
Do you see it as a conflict?
I've tried to avoid treating it as a conflict. I think it's kind of a one-of-a-kind case.
Which one? Thompson?
Thompson. Where the Court of Appeals, I see it more as almost like an equitable kind of thing. I think if you look at it from the perspective of Beetz, I don't think it's correct. I think the Court of Appeals in its certification was driving at the idea that Thompson was not decided correctly because there's no real way to distinguish juvenile custody from custody in adult court. And I think that's correct.
Isn't part of the reason for the distinction in Thompson that maybe I've I'm missing something. Doesn't it have to do with the nature of juvenile proceedings and the fact that we're not dealing with sentences, we're dealing with juvenile confinement for other purposes? Isn't that in large part, and I think it was in Hesse as well, isn't that part of what's driving the distinction between juvenile and adult matters?
Well, I think that's true, although the 973.155 doesn't distinguish on the basis of custody. I mean, it doesn't say, well, you get it if you have one standard for custody resulting from a juvenile disposition. You have a different standard for custody based on an adult disposition or adult sentence. Thompson itself said Beats didn't apply because Beats dealt with a sentence. But as the certification suggests, what's the distinction? Because the issue is custody. And the source of the custody. You're in custody whether you're on a juvenile disposition or whether you're on an adult sentence. And the question is whether the custody for which you want the sentence, the credit for which you want the sentence, was in connection with the offense for the charges of the conduct for which the sentence is being imposed. And so I think what the certification anyway was driving at was that whatever the rationale might have looked like in that specific case, however the Court of Appeals might have looked at it at that point, when you assess it in terms of custody, in terms of the actual language of the statute, it doesn't really make a lot of sense. It's not consistent with the notion of in connection with. It's dealing with this artificial distinction between custody resulting from a sentence as opposed to custody resulting from a juvenile disposition. And 973.155 doesn't make that distinction.
Counselor, do you contest that the 32 days Mr. Johnson spent in Dane County Jail are not entitled to sentence credit?
I think that's I dispute it because it hasn't been shown that is in connection in the way that the statute would require. I don't know why. I mean, one of my colleagues says that there's a federal statute that prohibits keeping juveniles with adults in confinement facilities. I'm not sure why they characterize it as the jail, because it seems to be that would be inappropriate. Even segregation might have been inappropriate.
Dane County has a separate locked, secure facility for juveniles. And unless I've misread the record, he was not placed there, but was placed in Dane County Jail.
I think that's what was said in the affidavits or whatever.
But if we assume that's true, let's just assume that's true, just for sake of argument. If he's in that facility, he certainly isn't in that facility for a juvenile offense, because that's not where we put our juveniles. So I guess my question to you is, if you don't put juveniles in the jail, and he's in the jail for a period of time, do you still contest that he should not have credit for those days in jail?
Well, because I don't know why he wound up there. Whether because of overcrowding they had to accommodate him through a segregated facility in the jail proper itself. I mean, it might have been an emergency situation that they kept him there. I would not concede that he's entitled to those. And I went around with some of my colleagues on this in the sense that if you have two individuals, say Johnson 1 and Johnson 2, Johnson 1 has to be brought over from Ethan Allen, Johnson 2 is over in Mendota, Johnson 1 comes over and they have to keep him for whatever reason in the jail. Johnson 2, they just bring over to the court and then bring him back. What you've got is two people, same situation, except one happens to get sentence credit because of whatever the serendipity of the situation is. So it's in that context that I'm saying I don't concede that this necessarily resulted. It might very well. But again, that goes back to the fact issue of whether the custody is in connection with. And again, that gets back to the question of who bears the burden, and it's clear that the defendant bears the burden on that proof.
Let me add a little bit, and this is just hypothetical because neither of us know exactly what might bear on this. It's in the record or could have been put in the record. Just say that there's not overcrowding in secure detention, and because this fellow has had some very confrontative events with other inmates, they confine him as an adult during the period of time he's waiting for trial and having motions and so forth on the adult charges. Mm-hmm. Would you then concede he gets credit, or is this simply just an overlay on the juvenile detention that underlies it?
I think it's still an overlay on the juvenile, but at the same time, I'm perfectly prepared to say that this goes back to the point about the fact relationship that has to exist and who bears the burden. Mm-hmm. And if he can show that his presence in the jail was not related to the juvenile confinement, that they specifically make a decision, this is an adult charge, we're putting you in the adult jail, I would not try to fight the notion that would be sentence credit worthy.
Okay. So what that gets to is that you can have an underlying juvenile detention, and just say this is ongoing, he's not getting out of juvenile, and an adult charge that occurs. So if he's put in the adult jail for an adult charge, then is it the most immediate reason for his placement? I mean, how do we segregate that out as we compare it with adults who are confined in prison, brought down to the jail for a trial, and then sent back to prison on the first charge?
This is why I say it again. It's kind of a factual question.
Yeah, I know.
Because as I think Mr. Findley said, the location of the custody shouldn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
The question is what it's in connection with, and that I hate to say it like a second or third time, I guess, but it really does. And this is one of the things that I regret I didn't make more clear in my brief. But the point is, and it's well established that it is a factual question that has to be determined, and it's the defendant's burden to make that proof.
Thank you,
counsel. In connection with. Custody in connection with. That's not custody for the crime sentence. It's broader than that, it seems to me. The legislature chose language in connection with.
The conduct, right.
And you agree with that.
Yes.
Now, as I understand it, the facts, some of them I may not understand, but I thought that at the extension in May 6, 2003, that it was undisputed that request for extension considered or factored in, I don't know to what extent, but that it factored in a reference to the criminal charge. Do you agree with that? I mean, it referenced it.
I would dispute there's a reference, as I recall, in the second request, that after detailing all of his conduct, there's a paragraph, as I recall, that says something along the lines, it should also be noted that. It was like an aside to the whole thing. And my point about the factual inquiry, and I think what the certification was going at when it talked about this factual gap, was what did that mean? Was that simply this is something that has happened, or is this a factor in the decision about whether to hold him?
One of the things that I'm concerned about is that something be real workable, practical. I don't want to get in a situation where we say, well, it's a factor, but it's only 80-20 or 65-35. In our definition, because what we're doing now, we're not making up things. We're talking about how broadly do you define in connection with, as I see it. Do you define in connection with almost in a but-for sort of way? Or do you define in connection with in a broader sense? That is, it takes into consideration. I don't know if it takes into consideration 10%, or I don't know if it's 80%, but it takes into consideration. And if it takes into consideration, then the argument is it's in connection with. So aren't we really just focusing on how broadly or restrictively you want to define in connection with?
I think that's exactly it. And Mr. Findley proposes that in connection with provide sentence credit any time a juvenile is in juvenile custody.
In connection with?
And no, that if there's a criminal charge filed while this individual is in juvenile custody, regardless of whether they were kept in.
Okay.
So he's taken very broad.
My
position is that Beats functionally creates a but-for test.
You know, it seems to me that this is a Goldilocks case. And that is, he wants it very broad, you want very narrow, and some place in between is probably just right. And maybe it's just right. I don't know this. I'm just playing around with this. But maybe it's just right when the record reflects that it was taken into consideration. If the record doesn't reflect that it was taken into consideration, then I don't care if he has some other criminal charges pending. I mean, that's the real I don't want the real broad, let's say. But if the record reflects that it was taken into consideration, and I don't have to be bogged down by 10%, 15%, 80%, I don't care. If the record reflects it, then it is in connection, the custody is in connection with.
And that, I think, gets to the conceptual issues about, well, what do you do about somebody who's on an indeterminate sentence? Why, since the custody standard is the same, regardless of what should be the same, at least under the statute, of the basis for deciding how much in connection with there is, if somebody is, the argument was made, and I think it was made in Beats and a couple of other cases, I'm in here in part because of this other crime I committed that resulted in the revocation of my sentence. Therefore, I'm here in connection with. That's the drop of, it's sort of like the drop of gasoline in the rain barrel.
It's what?
It's the drop of gasoline in the rain barrel. The drop of gasoline pollutes the entire rain barrel. It makes it undrinkable, theoretically. If there's even a smidgen of connection in this broad sense, then sentence credit gets applied. I don't think that's what the statute provides, and I don't think that's what Beats is setting out as the standard for determining what in connection with means.
It seems to me you can't have it both ways. Beats is a criminal case. Thompson was a juvenile case. If you want to rely on criminal case, then this is a penal statute. And penal statutes are supposed to be, there's a statutory maximum of construction for penal statutes, which essentially inure, the ambiguities inure to the benefit of the defendant. Right? Why wouldn't that apply? If your criminal analogy holds, then why doesn't that maximum of construction for penal statutes also apply?
Because the determination, the interpretation of the meaning of in connection with isn't confined to a custody as a result of a criminal conviction or a criminal proceeding. Custody is very broadly, is supposed to be broadly determined.
What can be more penal than this?
In which?
How long are you going to be behind bars? That sounds pretty penal to me. Isn't that what we're talking about?
Sure, but when we're trying to decide whether that time behind bars is resulting in connection with and how much credit you should get for custody where you have two or more bases for the custody, that's where we're trying to determine how much, which of that custody is in connection with and which isn't. And the statute doesn't make it a distinction between custody that's based on a juvenile disposition and custody that's based on a criminal disposition. It's asking, is this custody in connection with? Beats has taken a narrow view of what in connection with means. I can't remember the name of the case, the Floyd, this court said that there has to be a factual connection, not just a procedural connection. The factual connection here is brings me back to the question of how do you determine whether the fact of this connection. And in some cases, I think it requires a circuit court to make factual findings. It may require calling somebody from the juvenile system who's familiar with the case to say, yeah, that we had this is in the report, but there was no way in the world we were going to let him out. You could have taken that out. We have 19 million other things. He wasn't responding to treatment. He wasn't responding to these other things. And the judge makes a determination whether it was in connection with or not.
Mr. Wren, you lead your brief off with the argument that perhaps this should be determined as improvidently granted and remanded to the circuit court for an evidentiary hearing. You then say, well, maybe we don't need it because we have a different record here
right.
than the Court of Appeals had. Do we have the same record that the circuit court had?
No, I don't believe so.
We have a different record because we have a record of the various juvenile proceedings that neither the circuit court nor the Court of Appeals had.
We
granted that motion. I'm not complaining about that.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to figure it all out for the moment. And on the basis of that record, if I understood your brief, and basis of this new record, you would conclude that the juvenile was detained, or his institutionalization was extended because of this charge and the various other things he did, which were even more significant, that it was highly probable even without this charge he would have been kept in. Is that right?
I think I wrote in my brief that if the circuit court had these records,
right.
it wouldn't have said extremely high probability. It was a certainty.
And
that's the way I regard it.
All
but
right.
I think
that's your interpretation of this new record that we
That's
have
my interpretation court. Of the new record, yes.
If we were to remand this for an evidentiary hearing, what would we ask the circuit court to determine?
I think what the circuit court would have to determine is whether he would have continued in the juvenile custody regardless of these new charges, of the discharge battery. We know that the first extension occurred without any reference to this. The real question, the factual question in a sense is, there are two, and I think the certification gets to this. How long would he have been confined? Given the fact that in a juvenile setting, they can release a person at any time, theoretically, the whole time might be available. I take the position that they were not going to let him out on that first extension, and to the extent that there might be a factual question to resolve, it would be the impact of these charges on the second extension.
So in other words, you'd say, how long would he have been confined in the juvenile institution without the assault? How long would he have been confined with the assault? So that would be your...
I think we know how long he was with
that,
the assault.
Right, okay. Because that's,
so the question is was without the assault.
Was, okay.
And that would, as I think I suggested, it's going to require, calling the social worker, the people who dealt with Mr. Johnson in that setting to explain what their procedures were, what they took into account, and what impact, if any, this would have had on it. It would also go to, I think, Justice Rogensack's question about what was the reason for him being in the jail portion when he was brought over for the hearings.
Chief, may I?
Yes.
Do you have to take consideration in the question, would he have been confined in juvenile custody regardless what judge you're dealing with? Some judges have a greater inclination to have kids in secure detention or have them in a halfway house, send them to Rawhide. I mean, how many times did I get a request, Lincoln Hills, and I said, Rawhide. That's an old TV show.
Well,
do that again.
In this context, what you have is an established fact of where he was sent. He was sent to, he was kept in the juvenile facility he was in before this whole thing started. So I don't see that. Maybe that's an issue for a further case where we have a record where that issue is raised.
Well, it seems like that's what, in part, you want to know. You want to know if the judge would have ordered the continued, it's the judge, not the social
right.
worker. The social worker can recommend all day long until they're blue in the face. It's what the judge is going to do. And so you're asking really what the judge would have done, how that was judge's determination.
As I understood it, it becomes, once the decision to extend is made, the decision to release is not within the judge's purview, but within DOC or the juvenile system's purview. I mean,
but which way are we looking at it? Whether or not it was extended, or whether he should have been released? That was the point of my question about evidentiary hearing. Because are you looking at whether he would have been released early, or did the judge put him in on an extended period?
In consideration,
right.
Part of this criminal charge.
The criminal charge. And then why bring in the social workers, et cetera? Why not just send it back to the original judge and say, with all due respect, what the devil did you do? What was inspiring you to do this? And maybe the judge has to reexamine the record, or maybe, we've done that and said to the judge who's done sentencing, what exactly did you have in mind?
Well, I think there are two issues in terms of how long he's going to be in there. One involves the judge. The other involves the people who are treating him. The judge is involved in the decision on whether to extend. The social workers and so on are involved in, once he's in there, whether to release him. So the judge would be in this sense, to the extent that the judge needs to explain his or her thought process. The second extension decision is the only one that's involved here. Everything else is in relation to whoever's treating Mr. Johnson.
I don't know why you can say that, because it may be that he would have been released early if the social, but for the assault.
That's what the factual inquiry is
about.
That's
in the first extension, too.
Right, and that's my point. But the judge's decision on whether to extend that first time isn't an issue.
That's right.
The social
he
worker
is at issue.
Pardon?
Is at issue.
Not the first extension.
No, the second.
The second extension, yes.
So you want both the circuit judge and you want an evidentiary hearing from the social workers.
I'm not saying I want that. I'm saying that's the way
that
it would have to be resolved.
Let's move away from the facts of this case for a moment. And let's forget Thompson. I'm even willing for the moment to forget Beats. What should the rule of law be in interpreting 973.155 when you have a juvenile in an institution and now charged with a crime?
What should the rule be?
Yeah.
I think the rule that the defendant, the juvenile, that however we want to characterize him, has the obligation of showing that he would have been released but for those additional charges.
All right. You're still with but for. Okay.
Still with Beat.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Wren.
Thank you.
Emily?
I don't agree that the burden is on the juvenile to prove that he's entitled to credit. There was no briefing on that, and I certainly don't concede that. But if that were true, basically what Mr. Wren is asking for is for a situation in which the juvenile could never get credit. There I go again, saying no. But it would be very, very difficult for the juvenile to prove that they hadn't factored in any connection to the adult charges. And so what it would create is, I think, a very unworkable situation. What the juvenile would have to do to try to get credit is to subpoena DOC officials, his social workers, and present a record saying that yes or no, they did or did not consider all of this. You're creating litigation. You're creating litigation. You're creating a burden on the courts to determine. If, on the other hand, you say, look, if there is a connection, you're entitled to credit, the Goldilocks rule, then that's all we need to determine. It's a much simpler test, and that is why I believe that there has been no significant litigation following Thompson. The alternative is more appendices like this. The courts are going to be wrapped up into did or did not they consider it, who has the burden, et cetera, and so on. And you're just asking for more litigation. It doesn't need to be that difficult. Furthermore, as you've identified when you were asking questions of Mr. Wren, how can you ask a court or the department to go back and say, what would you have done if you didn't know, when they, in fact, did know he had committed these offenses? It's pure speculation after the fact, and there's no way to do it fairly and uniformly across courts and across social workers.
Well, the court can say, when you have a fact situation like this, where you've got a juvenile in an institution, and there's been a criminal charge, and there's an extension of the juvenile, that one of the findings the court has to make in extension is determining whether it is taking into account the crime. I mean, just put it on the record.
But it's not just the court. I disagree. It's also the department.
Yeah, but the ultimate decision is who? At least initially, to extend, it's the courts, right?
Well, first the department makes a recommendation to the court.
I understand that. Whose ultimate decision is it?
It's the courts.
Okay. But the release is not the courts. Whether you're going to release early.
That's correct.
Okay.
But what you're doing is you're asking attorneys to come and present a bigger, better record to the court saying, you know, this guy deserves to be released, or they've considered this. I mean, they were going to release him, but for... If you adopt that test, you're asking for more litigation and more hassle.
You know, what we really have to do is let the trial court judge understand what the credit is going to be. Because if the credit is 600 and whatever number of days, and the judge thinks the juvenile should spend more time in prison than that, then the sentence will be rendered appropriately, assuming that you've got enough time in the crime. But if the judge thinks that it's not 617 or 27, whatever, days, the judge is going to say sentence for credit is credit served.
I agree the proper way to resolve this would be just to resolve it at sentencing on the criminal case.
No.
It can be taken care of that way.
Right.
And so the simplest rule is just to give them credit and say deal with it at sentencing. If I
ask you, Mr. Finley, from what little I know, public defender prepares papers for all the people who serve at the trial court level, highlighting cases, and I would imagine that the Thompson case has to be in there. Is this case used a lot, or, I mean...
I don't know the answer to that. I know that this case is not, you know, that it's not a completely unique situation. Certainly there are many, many juveniles who commit crimes while in corrections or on aftercare, or in type 2 institutions. I mean, it comes up. And the reason it hasn't been cited, I disagree, is because the current rule is simple. It works. There's no reason you need to devise a more complicated rule to adhere to Beats, which I think was an outlier. I mean, you know, nowhere in the statute does it talk about severing credit. I mean, Beats kind of flipped the test on its head, I think. And I have no problem living with Beats, but to extend it when you don't need to doesn't make sense. The current test works, and to create a different one is going to create more litigation and more work for the courts.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Wren, and thank you, Mr. Finley, for your arguments today on yet another sentence credit case. This concludes our hearing on 2005-18-1492 CR, State of Wisconsin versus Marcus Johnson. And again, I want to thank the counsel for their courtesy and waiting oral argument pending the completion of their child memorial. This court is in recess until its next oral argument, which is in Wautoma, and the court will meet in the conference room at 4:05.
Oh my, here we go.